Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 24th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jody Kretzman, who will be beginning his series on community. Today's session is number one and is titled Mississippi Burning Revisited, a forum on the torching of black churches. Let's listen in.
Tape Ministry. For our friends at Tape Ministry and for everybody here, let me introduce myself. My name is Jody Kretzman, and I'm here at Holden for a while, from Chicago, and didn't come at all prepared to do a session called Mississippi Burning Revisited, but clearly Holden has always been a place that has been responsive to events in the world around us, and we are all connected, it seems, to all of us, I think, to the sisters and brothers in primarily African-American churches across the United States that have been in increasing numbers being burned. And so I think it's consistent with Holden's spirit of connectivity to the world outside and down the mountain that we spend some time reflecting on that set of tragic and angering events, seeing if we can deepen our understanding about those events, and then carrying forth the discussion into a different kind of setting this evening with our Vesper services, which will also be centered on a kind of attempt to connect ourselves, even as we're here up the mountain, with sisters and brothers across the United States. I wonder if, because this is a little bit of a tough issue for all of us, if we might want to just center ourselves with a prayer for a moment. Dear God, please send your spirit upon this discussion. Open our hearts, open our minds. Spread your wisdom through the room. Connect our hearts and our heads. Bring us together with sisters and brothers who today are fearful that the center of their lives, the center of their connections with you, is threatened. Help us to understand the complex dynamics of your world, and help us to be forces for healing and reconciliation and koinonia. Send your spirit upon us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
This really is going to be a conversation, I hope, because nobody did come up prepared to do something on this. It's just unfolding before us, and I don't think there's anybody in the room, certainly including me, who can be an expert on this. But I want to, I thought I'd just spend a few minutes trying to frame our discussion and then invite everybody to be a part of this. And I thought we might sort of think very briefly about sort of three ways of going at this this discussion. One, to make sure that we've got some of the relevant common information before us, that we've got something about the numbers and the places and the events that we're talking about here. What is the universe of these events? How do we understand where they are? And I understand, I mean, I've been in the village since Friday, and it's changing over the weekends, right? So I'd like to be inviting people who've arrived since Friday to update us on what's been going on since then. Secondly, I thought we might spend some time profitably doing a little bit of introductory interpretation of these events. What do they mean from the point of view of the African-American community? What do they mean from the point of view of all of us as Americans? What do they mean? How do we understand them in terms of the social, cultural, political dynamics of the late 20th century? What is this event about? Can we put it into some kind of historical context? And then thirdly, I think it would be good for all of us to have to be in touch with as much as we can the range of responses from the churches across the United States to these events, from the public sector to these events, and as a way then of beginning to think of our own responses too, and how those might be orchestrated and organized in some way. And I think we want to do a little bit of that in Vespers this evening. Let me just start with then a word or two on what I understand to be the basis of a fact that we have before us. And let's be careful here, because there is so much that is not known as these events unfold. There are always in difficult and conflict-ridden times like these, there are always temptations to jump too early to conclusions about patterns and about a variety of forces which may or may not be involved, and we have to be, I think, a little bit cautious. What seems clear at this point, and I think the best numbers probably come from the National Council of Churches, which has been pushing this discussion not only among the churches nationally, but in Washington, D.C., and has been providing really a lot of the public sector with the numbers around these phenomena. And the Center for Democratic Renewal in Atlanta, which is a center in Atlanta which monitors hate crimes and which has been involved with the growing numbers of burnings of black churches over the last couple of years. There is some disagreement between the Center for Democratic Renewal and the National Council of Churches on the numbers. The National Council, Joan Campbell, the director there, talks about 25 plus burnings of black churches since January of this year, and 55, more than 55 since 1990. The Center for Democratic Renewal talks about more than 80 burnings of black churches since 1990, and by their count, about 38 as of last week. Since January of 1996. A couple of other things about the numbers. In most years in the 1970s and 1980s, it's always true that the African American church is the center of some hate in the United States. We are still in the middle of a basically racist reality, and the black church has always to some degree been in the center of that. But the numbers in the 70s and 80s have been about 2 to 4 a year, 2 to 4 black churches per year burning, mostly in the Southeast, and often as a result of local activity. So this is, if we're somewhere around 25 or 30 since January 1996, this is not only a mushrooming, but an explosion, if you will, of the numbers here. The states that have been involved that at least I know about are Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Oregon, Washington State, Arizona, and New Jersey. It's clear that in the last couple of months, the spread seems to have been out of the Southeast and into other parts of the United States. Got some additions?
I heard one report back in Seattle about a week ago that there are approximately more than 25 white churches being burned, plus about 6 synagogues, in addition to what we thought the blacks.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things to think about. I think what is the relationship to a larger set of dynamics, certainly involving synagogues and probably involving some white churches as well. Among the churches that are being sort of lumped into this large category of the black church are a whole lot of different kinds of churches, right? Some are traditional black churches where, in particularly throughout the South, where the minister is an African-American minister and it's an African-American congregation, AME or Baptist or other traditional black denominations. Others are, for instance, the big church in downtown Knoxville, Tennessee, was pastored by an African-American pastor, but was a highly mixed and integrated congregation and was the sort of center of multicultural life in that city. And I gather that the church that was burned in Portland, Oregon, was sort of like that 10 days ago. So it's not all traditionally black churches. It seems to be a mix of a variety of kinds of churches. A little footnote, Martin Luther King Day, our celebration nationally of Dr. King's birthday, has been a kind of focus for the burning of black churches over the last couple of years, six in around the country in 1995, and I think the count was eight for Martin Luther King Day in 1996. So far, there are approximately, at least by the last reading that I've done, about 30 arrests for the burning of the black churches, and about 90% of those 30 folks are white, male, between the ages of 17 at the young end and about 45 at the top end. Some of them have clear ties to hate groups, others do not. A word or two about interpretation. Those are the sort of facts of the matter, at least as I can. We'll talk some about the responses as well in a moment. Let me just suggest a couple of quick interpretive categories here. And I think for me, the reason I wanted to call this session Mississippi Burning Revisited is that for me, like I'm sure a lot of you in this room, the African American church has been a second church home for me. It has been a place in the last 35 years of my life of almost constant spiritual renewal. My first experience with the black church was in the civil rights movement, and when as a 19-year-old college student I went to Mississippi to register voters for a time, and it was clear to me very quickly that that the black church in small town Mississippi was at the center of spiritual life in a way that was incredibly important and quite unfamiliar to me as a Lutheran, and that it was also a place where the distinctions between public and private were quite different than what I was used to, where the church was not only the center of spiritual lives for the individuals who were part of the congregation, but the church was also the place where the powerful discussions about the place of the community in the larger world took place. So that when we opened our Freedom School that summer for voter education, the logical place to have it was in the local Baptist church. And that Baptist church was a center of strong public presence for the folks in that area, and were those folks through that institution opened their arms to people who were coming in from the outside. And since then, I, like I'm sure a whole lot of other folks in this room, have found the black church to be a wonderfully welcoming and affirming and spiritually stretching place to be, even with those for those of us who have our roots in another kind of religious experience. It was those days, in the days of the Mississippi Burning movie. By the way, I don't mean by titling this session Mississippi Burning Revisited to endorse that movie. It was, from my point of view, one of the worst movies ever made about the civil rights movement. So if you do, they got the title right, but they got almost everything else wrong about what went on that summer. But there are other good films about that period of time. The last large wave of burnings of black churches was in the early 1960s. In a period of about 2.5 years, over 30 black churches were burned in Mississippi alone, and more than 100 were torched from the period of 58 to 63 across the southeast. All of us, I think, still have, at least those of us who are old enough, in our memories, the shocking memory of coming to church on a morning in 1963 and hearing about the bombing in Birmingham, in which four young girls were killed while putting their choir robes on as the church was bombed. So this is not the first time the black church has been in the line of fire. And in fact, the early 1960s was not the first time that the black church has been in the line of fire. All of us, I think, are aware of the kind of incredibly rich dual character of the African American church. Born in slavery from its inception. We learn now from scholars like E. Franklin Frazier and others that the African American church had a peculiar, powerful dual function. On the one hand, it was the place where slaves could say, and the only place that slaves could say, this is ours. This is our place. This is a safe place. This is the sanctuary. This is the place where we are community. It is the place where our language and our rhythms and our songs can be at the center of our spiritual life. So it was, on the one hand, a kind of place of escape and withdrawal in the times of slavery, and that tradition is still there very strongly in the African American church. But at the same time, since the beginning of its invention, really, in the days of slavery, the African American church has always been the platform from which the black community engages the larger world, right? From which a public presence becomes evident, from which leaders become trained and launched into the larger discussion. So it has these two faces, one inward-looking and spiritually centered and a powerful kind of community place that's safe and inviolable, which is another reason why this bombing is so tragic, right? But the other face is the face which projects the black community over the years into public. Historically, I think it's fair to say that the black church has been the target of racist activity most frequently in the periods where more and more of those churches were in fact taking the public role seriously. That is where in fact the black community in its constant going back and forth between engagement and withdrawal, right? Between having some hope that there might be some possibilities in a larger culture on the one hand, and sort of regressing back into a kind of hopelessness in a way. I mean, that's been a set of poles of activities in the black community throughout its history, and the church has been the center of that. When the church has been projecting folks into public life, whether it was in the abolitionist movement or then in the civil rights movement, or in the case of a lot, but not all of the churches in this recent wave of bombings and burnings, the church seems then to have aroused the attention and gotten the focus of the larger society and then become the focus of enmity and hate. So I do think it's important for us to understand this not as an isolated historic event, but one that is embedded in the ongoing history of the African American experience in the United States, of the history of racism in the United States, and of the history of the central history of the black church within that that ongoing story. It is a little bit, let me just one last interpretive remark, and I'd love to see what some of the rest of you think about this. It's a little puzzling to me that so much of white America, which seems obviously we seem to be in a time in our own history where permission for racism is there, where there's a kind of general acceptance that it's okay to be exclusionary in a variety of ways and to circle the wagons, because there's an awful lot of fear, I think, in the majority culture in the United States, and we all experience that. But it is not a period of time, generally, it seems to me, where particularly Euro-Americans perceive African-Americans as a threat in any particularly sort of powerful way, so that there's it is not, in a sense, the rebirth of a civil rights movement that calls forth the wrath of a part of white America here, and so it's a little bit puzzling, and I think trickier to understand what's going on here. And it does seem that not all of the 80 churches that have been the targets of fire and violence have been churches which have been the center of public activity. Not all of them have been. Some of them seem to be simply the sanctuary kinds of churches and not the public kinds of churches. So I'd like to see maybe what some of the rest of you have to say about this. Finally, just a couple opening remarks and responses. Within the world of the church, probably nationally, the National Council of Churches has been most clearly at the center of the discussion about responses. The NCC has pledged to raise $2 million for a rebuilding fund for the black churches and has been in discussion with a variety of the African-American denominations about what it is they would like to see. We're going to, Ann Hafton, who is with us here, but is also on the, oh, here you are. Let me ask you in a minute to talk about the, particularly about Lutheran responses, as we know about them. Let me say a word or two other, more about other responses. Many of you have followed, I think, that the pressure that's been put on the Clinton administration to respond to this. Group of black pastors were lobbying the White House fairly heavily over the last 6 months, as was the NCC, the National Council of Churches, and it does seem that in the last 6 weeks or so, the administration has awakened to this issue, and many of you probably noted that President Clinton hosted 30 of the pastors who had their churches burned at the White House and then visited South Carolina and helped to rededicate a church that was burned in 1995 there. In terms of law enforcement responses, the FBI has a fairly sizable contingent working on these cases, according to Janet Reno, as does the Bureau of the AFT, the Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco Bureau at the federal level. Vice President Gore and a number of leaders in the Congressional Black Caucus has been involved in helping local churches and local communities set up watches around churches so that the local responses get some kind of support and are organized in some way that makes sense. And an interesting development, I think, in the national discussion, the NCC, the National Council of Churches, was joined by the Christian Coalition, the conservative churches, who were also professing their concern about this question and mobilizing their members to contribute to the rebuilding as well. And then finally, the philanthropic sector has weighed in over the last 6 weeks or so with some heavy commitments. Seven major foundations, including Ford and MacArthur and Kellogg and so on, have pledged $1.7 million for the rebuilding fund at this point. So there are a variety of national responses beginning to be developed to this set of events, and I think clearly a growing kind of local response too. One hears more and more about folks from a variety of churches joining together with the parishes that have been burned to rebuild the individual churches. Ann works, when she's not on the Holden board, at the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in Chicago, and you have the latest information on what at least the ELCA is doing, and maybe somebody here can help us with some of the other Lutheran responses.
Yeah, I wish my information was a little bit more current, but what I can share is based on the week that I left to come up here and then our more recent facts from the National Council of Churches. My work at the ELCA is in the news department, so I do have access to the news of this issue, and I've been watching it come across through National Council of Churches news releases, particularly for some time. And I think my understanding is that their first involvement began to be out of a sense of inattention to these cases on the part of both the law enforcement community and the media. And so they began to try to formulate a response very early, months ago, and try to gain attention to this issue by both the media and the law enforcement people. They put together an investigative task force that would go into these settings and try to find out more of the causes and look at the community and what were the dynamics there and what's going on in ways that the law enforcement folks were not doing. And one member of the staff of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Gaylord Thomas, who is director for community development in the Division for Church and Society, became a part of that team. I want to say here, I wish I knew and could report what the actions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod have been. And I don't know that. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is not a member of the National Council of Churches. So if you are from the Missouri Synod, please go home and find out, because I'm sure they're doing something, and we just don't know that here.
Well, tell us if you know.
Yeah, tell us if you know. It's unfortunate that we don't have that information. Part of the role the ELCA has had for now some months, is the participation of Gaylord Thomas as part of these investigative teams, and a third of his salary, salaried time, and all his travels being paid for by the ELCA. What he's found in going into these settings is that more than investigation is needed. There's also a ministry of reconciliation and of consolation that's needed there. And trying to set that up is sort of like another part of this work. And it wasn't really the intended work of the investigative teams, but it kind of fell to them in some cases. And he did some talking about that with our staff at the church headquarters just before I left. And I wasn't able to go to that session, so I wish I could tell you more about what he said. Then the ELCA gave an outright gift of $10,000 to the fund that National Council of Churches started for rebuilding and addressing the issues of racism that are at work here. And that came out of ELCA domestic disaster response funds. And I'm sure it won't be the only gift, because lots of people will be participating in the fundraising. Some Synod assemblies began making resolutions at their meetings this spring addressing this, and I don't have the list of all of them, but Bishop Anderson chose to quote from the action taken by the South Carolina Synod in his letter to ELCA bishops of the week of June 13th. He said, "I support the action of our South Carolina Synod in opposing these acts of hatred and destruction and vowing to improve the climate of racial and ethnic relationships within our congregations and surrounding communities." This synod, this particular synod assembly, apparently was hand-delivered to Janet Reno's office. This happened after I left Chicago, so I can't give you the particulars about how that happened. But I do know that this isn't the only synod that addressed this in their assembly. So when you leave here, if you want to pick this up, and I hope you will, call your synod office and find out, or ask your pastor what your synod has done in terms of this. There were a bunch of such resolutions. I want to make sure I'm hitting all the bases here. Did you share this quote from Joan Brown Campbell?
No.
I'll read it. Joan Brown Campbell from the National Council of Churches testified before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, and I thought her quote was worth sharing. "It is our contention that these are not isolated random incidents, but rather pieces in a pattern of hate crimes that have been underreported by the media and overlooked by law enforcement. It is a sad state of affairs that in 1996, this nation is quietly and in many cases unwittingly accepting the racist destruction of houses of worship." That's a fairly radical thing to say and worth thinking about here. I guess the last thing I'll share is just to say there are opportunities for volunteering in the rebuilding effort and taking part financially in supporting it. When I left Chicago, the word I had heard was that the National Council of Churches was going to form a partnership with Habitat for Humanity for some of the construction, and that sounds like a great partnership. Now, I don't see anything in these current materials that says that outright, but if it were the case, wouldn't that be great? And there are ways to volunteer. There's a phone number in this material. You can call an 800 number at the National Council of Churches, and I think it's probably safe to say that I can post this somewhere in today or after the worship service tonight, maybe in the dining room, but we'll announce that. These materials will give the number to call for to volunteer or to give money.
Yes. And you talk about the reconciliation teams. What other kinds of folks are on those teams?
I just don't know. I'm sorry. but I'm sure...
I wasn't thinking of names as much as where do they come from.
Yeah, I know they come from the member churches of the National Council of Churches, and they're probably people just like Gaylord Thomas, giving up time from their regular job, but I just don't know the answer.
And we will be collecting an offering tonight at the worship service as part of a summer-long effort at Holman Village to collect money and lift up this issue. So tonight will be the first opportunity.
I think these responses are really necessary, and it's good to hear that our national church and your office and others are responding. But there's also another level to which all of us can respond to it. If, in fact, it is very much of the hate and bigotry and racism that lies behind it, every one of us ought to be thinking about ways that we can deal with that in our own communities, because it is not only in the churches where it is happening, it's right where we live. And maybe that's some of the conversation we should begin having. How do we deal with that in our neighborhoods, in our families, in our own churches?
Absolutely.
We're from North Carolina, so we've been opposed to some of it. Another thing that's complicating...
Let me just stop for a second. Is there anything else? Ann, you have to go back to the board meeting.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is there anything else directly for Ann? Because we're going to lose her here in a second. In terms of information that, from the ELCA or from... Okay, Ann, thank you for playing hooky at the board. I'm sorry.
Another thing that's complicating the whole issue is the way law enforcement has gone on and the investigations afterwards. They have treated the members of the churches like criminals.
Yes,
and
often.
Really very badly handled the whole investigation.
Yeah.
And I think when the black pastors met with President Clinton, he was bringing that to Janet. They were pushing that very hard,
mm-hmm.
and bringing that to Janet Reno's attention, too, to tell their people going in not to do that stuff.
Yeah. That was apparently particularly true in the early investigations, that the immediate suspects were the members of the churches.
Yes.
Right.
Question?
Yes.
You said there had been 30 arrests around these. Now, is that
something like 30?
How long a time period? Because
that's in the arrests. Those are arrests in the burnings from 1990.
Okay.
To the present, not all the 96.
Okay.
I don't think there are very few of the 96.
Right. That was my understanding.
Right.
At least as couple weeks ago, there had been just this 13-year-old girl in North Carolina and a couple of men in Texas, and so that.
And a few confessions, yeah.
The latest spats.
Yeah.
Undetected as far as who was doing it.
Yeah. I think you're right to raise the question of a broader question of racism, what we can do in our communities. I wonder whether there's, we've got a lot of wisdom in this room about what's been going on here. I wonder does anybody want to raise any, add stuff on the table here about what's been happening and what more information? Anything else from Carolina? Tell us who you are.
Sherry Little.
Hi, Sherry.
One thing that I really pick up strongly, and I don't know, I pick it up in North Carolina, is the anger of people, especially in the white community, the anger of just, you know, bumper stickers like Nike can beat up your honor roll child, you know, and the how the bumper stickers are going to the bathroom and stuff. And there just seems to be a whole atmosphere of just a lot of anger that people are carrying. It just seems to be okay to vent that anger.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of climate in our nation.
Yeah. And often not very focused anger, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of generalized anger, which comes out of what? Fear, despair. Ted?
I think the scapegoating...
Say who you are, Ted.
Ted Johnstone from Washington. And I think scapegoating, I connect with that. We're not sure of how to respond. I think there's a frustration about how to respond, but we've let a lot of things go for a long period of time. Just from comments, I work in a school system that's pretty, generally I would say, pretty sensitive. And bringing up this issue even around the teacher's lounge became rather tense in the sense of, well, that's the 60s. Okay. Mm. Well, we took care of that. Mm. What are we bringing this up for? Also there were white churches too. I mean, it was a very common response that you know, I tend to almost want to do as well as a part of me is to say, well, it isn't just black churches, it's all the churches. And so we are dealing, if that's the case, we're dealing with even more commonality to take a look at what we're doing in the society, you know, in violent, angry outburst, dealing with that issue. So,
yeah, absolutely.
But we're looking for, it's not me, but it's the kind of responses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
In it with people who are terribly sensitive,
yeah.
I would say.
In responding to that anger.
Introduce yourself to
me. My name is Ned Miller. And
from?
From now Astoria, Oregon.
Okay.
But it's a long pattern.
Okay,
I
got
it. I won't get it there.
Okay.
Anyway, it seems like it sets the stage, and it's a really striking stage, because the unemployment rate for a lot of young black men and women, having worked with at-risk youth the last 4.5 years, I see a lot of anger in that population coming in from Compton and other areas of the West Coast. And I'm sure there's a lot going in the South and the North and the East. But I think it sets up the stage for the Miami riots, the LA riots, Philly, Washington, D.C., even our state capital. I mean, this is just gonna anger a number of those things. And looking at 1969 and reversing those numbers to 1996, it's almost like we're going through that pendulum swing again, that this is a review of what's happened in the past, because we've neglected a lot of things in dealing with this issue and being ostriches, sort of being heads in the sand, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
John? I'm John Clark from Holden Village. While all this has been going on, there was that great march on Washington, was it in January? Huge number of people, including Maya Angelou, I believe, and many people from the Nation of Islam. And I recently have lived in West Virginia, where I'm sure the reaction there would be, well, what are those people talking about? We're just as poor as they are. And I just want, and there seemed to be a very little response from the president to that march. And I'm wondering if there's just a fear of responding to the needs of black people, because it'd also be necessary to respond to the poor whites. I know that in West Virginia, white folks don't want to hear how badly black folks are.
You're talking obviously about the Million Man March last November, right?
Yes.
In Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
Whatever it was, 800,000, but close to a million probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the differences obviously between now and the 1960s is that civil rights made it onto the national agenda when the economy in general was expanding, and when therefore the redistributive challenge was a little bit easier to deal with. And now it's not expanding in exactly the same way. It's not expanding with a lot of openings for people sort of at the bottom of the economic ladder and ways to get on it, new opportunities and so forth. So that the fears you're arguing, are widespread and cross racial lines.
And at the same time, of course, there's the problems of the nation are going to be solved by cutting back on welfare.
Yeah.
For both whites.
Yes.
More whites on welfare than blacks.
Yes.
What is the, in terms of timeline?
Say who you are.
I'm Carol Bims from Porterville, California.
Right.
It seems like it was around 1990 that there was a persecution of the police officers in California for beating up the black guy. And I wonder if that maybe acted as a catalyst, because I know that in California there were a lot of mixed feelings. The blacks were very angry. I happened to be at our Senate convention in Oakland when that verdict was being handed down. And we were really warned to stay real close and in big groups because they didn't know if the city was going to explode. And at the same time, as I went back home and the white man had been convicted, there was a lot of anger that, you know, they were saying 17 seconds of the tape. And then this guy keeps suing, has sued again and again. And I know in California, there's been a lot of anger among the white community. I teach, so I hear a lot of teachers' opinions. towards this individual, which I wonder how much that's projected out. And in the South, where the black anger is deeper rooted, if that's part of what has caused the explosion.
You know, it is interesting. If you think about the last 5 years or so, almost all of the major public events, right, which the media carry out into our consciousness, are events which are interpreted radically differently by black America and white America, right? Whether we're talking about Rodney King and that whole set of events, or whether we're talking about the O.J. Simpson, or whether we're talking about the Million Man March. In each of those, one could have discussions in the black community and discussions in the white community and think that you were on Mars and Venus, that they were just entirely different views of what the reality was. And we have not had that many sort of major public events in which consensus has been reached, where there's some common ground. I think you're pointing to a very, very important kind of backdrop for what's going on at the moment. Yeah.
Carrie Simmons from Spokane, Washington. All this, the talk about anger, it really reminds me a lot of the anger against immigrants that's going on, the anti-immigration, and then also the anger that we're dealing with a lot in this part of the country, which is against environmentalists or a government or whatever it is that is causing people who depend on resources to lose their livelihood. And it seems to me like anger is usually based on fear.
Yeah.
And it also reminds me of all of the information I've been hearing about the widening gap between the rich and the poor and the sort of economic crisis that's going on in that sense. And I'm wondering if this isn't, to some degree, a response to fear of economic consequences. And it seems like, I don't know my history real well, but it seems like it's pretty common that people, when they're fearful economically, respond against not the people who are the rich or in power, but are actually the ones that are the closest to them, so that black people or immigrants or people who are really not an economic threat are the ones that tend to be lashed out against.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you sort of think about us as sort of members of a large circle with lots of people, more people, you're saying, being pushed toward the margins of the circle, more and more frequently we have people sort of falling outside the circle. And you're saying that those folks who no longer think that their rules are the community's rules, right, will attack those folks closest to them. In other words, the other people who are closest to the margins. I think that's right. Yeah, I heard in many ways, I've got some disagreements with him, but I heard a brilliant speech by Louis Farrakhan a couple of weeks ago in which he said the Freemen in Montana are the other side of the coin, right, from the most violent youth gangs in the inner city. That both are manifestations of the way in which the edges of our community have not held, right, for people and have been pushed up sort of beyond.
Question?
Yes. Say who you are.
Marcia Riggers from Olympia. Any particular observations about why churches, why not other institutions in the community or homes or businesses? Why churches?
Well, that's what I tried to say in a couple of opening remarks. I think that it really is important, and probably the South, both the black South and the white South, has a better sense of this than we in the North do. Although those of us who've worked in the urban North over the years have a sense of it too, I think, that the very center of the black community is the church. That in a way that is not true in the Euro-American communities of various kinds, the African-American church has historically been and is today the primary place where people come together, both to build community and to find the strength to speak powerfully to the outside world. So it is very difficult to go through a list of very many African-American leaders and find any of them who were not generated out of the church. And I think there's a real sense of that in the South, particularly, but in lots of other places as well. That there's a power there, that this is about going to the center of the black community, not about picking something off the edge of it, right?
Don't you think also that smart bullies hit at what is seen as sacred? what is sacred to a community, if you can lash at that, it's just a bigger explosion.
Yes.
A bigger act.
Yes.
Mary Arneson, Olympia. There was a TV show on a few years ago, I'll Fly Away, I'll Fly Home, which was down in the South. I think gave a very accurate depiction of what the churches did for the blacks in the 50s.
Yeah, I just saw one brief part of that, but I think you're right. It was a very powerful piece of work.
Randy Wolberg from Palo Alto, California. One of the things that I think feels different now than 30 years ago, is the, at least in California, is University of California rescinding affirmative action, and a lot of other places doing that, and with the mentality of building a fence or a wall, you know, to keep people out. But with, within just miles is the incredible isolation. There is a disconnect, an isolation that is energized by the economic fear, I think. Somebody talked about that. And then the racial myths, a lot of the myths that, and this includes Chinese, Korean, high-tech people as well, and Hispanic people, as well as African-American. And that, and instead of having a dialogue or thinking that somehow we gain value by knowing these cultures, I think that's not a value. I think that the disconnect is that I'm going to waste my breath or time to figure out that culture. If they want to be in America, let them speak English, and I'm here, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that attitude, this posture of an over and against posture, is really difficult to create any dialogue or to build a sense of community. People just dig in deeper.
Absolutely. Jeff.
Jeff, when you talked about bullies, wise bullies, it suddenly made me think of rape and the fact that rape isn't about sexuality, which is what it looks like because it involves genitalia, but it's about power and it's about dehumanizing. And it's not all that mysterious, but it's very confusing because what you see is not what is going on.
Yeah, and obviously the history of racism in the United States is all about not only power, but the complicated sexuality of race and power. It's very, you know, all of the histories of lynching and so on. Barbara?
I'm sure we probably in this room know most of us agree on politics, but I think that it, in a sense, this issue challenges to see that it's all of a piece. I was going to bring up what Randy argued about affirmative action, that in our country now, in the political climate, there are strong moves to, I guess this would be Supreme Court rulings, to do away with the black districts, congressional districts, for example, and to do away with affirmative action. And I'm sure we don't agree on these congressional districts, but I remember looking at a map of the Massachusetts congressional districts, for example, all eight of which, or maybe it's more than eight, around Boston, all of which were represented by white congressmen, and they were the oddest-shaped districts you ever saw. It's not just the black districts, the new ones that are oddly shaped. It's political history, yet we don't speak out. And same on the affirmative action issue. I have on the door of my office a full-page ad from the New York Times saying affirmative action helps all of us, we need it. And then speaking out in favor of the first signer on that is H. George Anderson, the bishop of the ELCA. And I really was pleased to see that because I think we have to speak out. I was going to use the analogy of, I don't know if this is being said now, but I remember several years ago, Native American communities saying to, you know, nice Christians and New Agey types that wanted to use their religion, their sage ceremonies, their songs and stuff, and saying, you can't mine our communities just for our spirituality. You can't take our religion if you're not also willing to advocate for us politically and legally and stand up for our rights. And I think there's an analogous situation now of the way we tend to, we are so enriched by African-American spirituals and songs in our worship. Many of the songs Tom and Mary have been using are from the African-American community. We've been richly blessed, and I feel like the same thing you said about the black church, but that it's not fair for us white Christians to just take the songs and prayers and the spiritual vitality if we're not also willing to stand up and advocate for political change and at least defending what has been, because there's been a definite backlash in these last years. Joe?
Yes.
A few.
Hey, Ingrid.
Ingrid Christiansen from Chicago. I just remember the spring when that Supreme Court decision was taken, that there were headlines in Chicago saying something like, segregation is back. And an African-American friend of mine that I work with said, oh boy, it's going to be open season on blacks now. There's going to be a new level of permission, partly because of the headlines, you know, it was cast, but I think because of the decision, there's going to be a new level of permission to take out after us. And it wasn't long after that this started happening in larger numbers, these burnings. So it was sort of a I told you so eerie sense of
mortality. Can I just add something about fire setters?
Say who you are.
I'm Dave Peterson from Dallas, Oregon. I have no doubt that a lot of these fire burnings are racially motivated and that we should be discussing this. But also, it's important to realize that an awful lot of fire setters do it not for racial reasons, just because they like to set fires.
Sure.
And they like to sit back and watch fires, and it gives them power. And when you add to the mix, you got a whole national consciousness now focusing toward churches in the South. You're going to have a lot of fire setters who are going to love to burn black churches because it adds to their sense of power and feeling that they can have some control over things. So, you know, we got to also be looking at that it may not all be racial motivated. It may also be motivated by the attention that's being focused on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's absolutely clear that a whole lot of other motivations come in, but clearly race is a threat, at least in these activities that we're talking about today, that's also central.
Mm-hmm. In that same vein about the copycat situation, in instilling fear, terrorists love to instill fear, yeah, in their own way. And I think the railroad system is really suffering a great deal. We've had more railroad accidents than I've ever remembered in a long time. And I know some of those people personally that died this year. And the Oklahoma bombing was another example of how terrorism has hit our shores. And that's another way to make a real dysfunctional situation happen even more. You instilling the fear and that power, that whole area of what Jeff was talking about as well. It all interconnects. And yet at the same time, we need to turn that around to something positive. And making those churches again get some strength from our input or other inputs from those communities and letting them know that we're there to help from the ashes again.
Absolutely. What other notions do people have about potential responses that might be helpful? Tom,
do you know? I was just going to ask the question because it seems like we can get caught up in, you know, fake responses, not fake responses, but shell ones, which don't go beyond donating some money to churches that in reality we don't have any relationship with on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that would be bad, but it just seems like it's a first step. And I don't know, I'm looking for meaningful ways to kind of cross borders in my own city where Minneapolis is just terribly segregated between the churches. And, you know, I'm half a block from a black congregation, and there is absolutely no intermix between white and black churches. I guess there are probably clear steps, but none of us take them.
Perhaps this is an occasion. I mean, Jennifer, you were talking about the responses in Portland to the burning, which begins to involve people from a lot of other congregations gathering around.
Within a very short period. I'm Jennifer Grosvenor from Portland, Oregon, and Jody and I had an earlier conversation. Within a very short period of the burning of the church in Portland, initially some of the congregational members and then people in the neighborhood, but then just broad community, all of Portland. And in the evening, the pastor started to hold an outdoor service, and it started with 100 people there and ended up with 300 people there.
and in a matter of an hour. What the newspaper article did share was the interconnecting that was happening, and also a very, very careful and sensitive response by the pastor to not move to a point of reaction, but to also, by other community leaders, particularly Black community pastors who are part of an association, to also, with the broader community, to work towards dialogue with each other and to not have this become something that is divisive within the community, but to use it as an opportunity to talk about what's real.
Karen Mai, Oakland, California. Oakland is one of the large communities that hasn't had riots. Primarily they've been because of the Black leadership. And it was mentioned earlier during the Rodney King, the Black leadership got together and they had their own gathering that kept everything quiet. And they're taking leadership again now. And there's been, our church hasn't yet joined into it, but there are some of the larger churches that have joined us, and some of the suburban churches that are very white. And they're raising money. They're also starting to gather people together to send teams of 10 or 12 people to the churches to actually rebuild. And they're talking about, they're aiming to rebuild the churches just from that area. But we found in our own church that through a newspaper article about 4 years ago about a feeding program that was downtown. It happened to be in the building that our church was in the 20s. We just walked in and said, can we help you with your feeding program? And we've had a wonderful partnership with them for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And they were so receptive. So I think anybody could walk into any church and say, what can we do with you? And we found them just so receptive, and it's been a wonderful learning experience for us. We've been doing dishes and serving stuff, bacon, but they do the cooking because it's their food. They've considered us partners, and it's been really a learning experience.
Wouldn't it be terrific, in fact, if this moment turned out to be a set of opportunities for building relationships and sort of stepping across boundaries? Absolutely.
Carol Plain, Tacoma, and I think one of our responses can be that this is an election year, and I think it's more than just the burnings where racism is shown. I think our prison system is a racist society. I think there are more young Black men in prison than there are in college by great numbers. I don't think there's any rehabilitation going on in prison. I think it's a warehousing system. I think that's another example of our racism. And if you want to read a very hauntingly depressing book, Jonathan Kozol's new book, Amazing Grace, is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it shows the racism. Of course, it's much deeper in New York City, perhaps because of the sheer numbers of people. But I think we can see some of the same things happening in our communities, and voting is one way that we can have some voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think let's gather one more comment. Do you want to leap in one more time?
Roger Hardy from Minneapolis. Roger. One way in which we, as if we're talking to our in-house group here of Lutherans, is to develop the issue of partnership. For example, I would think in most of our communities where we live, if we are in smaller towns, suburbia, wherever, where we are probably not naturally going to be in a racially mixed community, although that's not always a given. But if that's the case, there are many of our own ELCA churches who are in racially mixed communities or in communities that are predominantly not white, that we could develop a relationship next week with. We could call those congregational presidents and those pastors and say, we'd like to be a mission partner with you to do what you did in Oakland in terms of just doing some actual activity, whether it's working with youth events or whatever it may be. So we can do it within our own ELCA.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Every one of us next week should do that. Every one of us.
Yes. Yeah. This discussion will go on, I hope, all week. And I hope we'll bring the discussion in our hearts to our service tonight. Let me just maybe close at this point with a couple of paragraphs from a piece that Barbara was kind enough to share with me from Ingrid and I have a neighbor in Chicago named Clarence Page, who's a columnist for the Tribune. And is syndicated in the Washington Post and the New York Times. Here's his column from a few days ago. Just a couple of quick observations. Page, of course, is, I think, the best African-American columnist writing in the United States these days. Not unambiguous about a lot of the controversial issues. He's very ambivalent about affirmative action, for example, thinks it's a lot of problems with it from the black community's point of view as well. Even in the gloomiest days of slavery, Page writes, the black church was something, often the only thing black people were allowed to call their own. They took full advantage of it. They used the church to lift up their spirits, strengthen their families, enrich their culture, and organize their politics. Every major movement African Americans have known, from the abolitionist movement to the black political empowerment movement, is rooted in the black church. Even as we black Americans move beyond the black church in pursuit of new corporate, political, educational, economic leaders, we can never leave it. Federal investigators, he says, are reluctant to say a conspiracy is involved in the recent wave of arson attacks on black churches. But there is, he says. There's a conspiracy of silence. There's also a conspiracy of denial, a conspiracy of timidity, and a conspiracy of permissiveness toward racism. To find the culprits, Page writes, let's all start by looking in a mirror. And his last paragraph. Problems are opportunities in disguise. Americans may yet draw new hope from this set of tragedies. In most places, Sunday morning is still one of the most segregated hours of the week. The tragedy of black church arsons is pulling together church and civil rights like no other issue since the 1960s. They must not be left to march alone. We Americans have more than enough conspiracies to divide us up. We need to conspire to bring ourselves together. So let's go out and be part of that conspiracy.